Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending. With real-time notifications, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producer is Patrick Antonetti. One guest on this podcast, but man, I really, really enjoyed this conversation. One of my favorite colleagues from Sports Illustrated, Michael McCann, is a legal analyst and senior sports legal reporter at Sportico. He is a professor of law at the University of New Hampshire's Franklin Pierce School of Law, where he's also the director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute. There is so much going on in terms of the intersection between sports and legal. And nobody better, in my opinion, in the United States, in terms of writing this stuff on a media basis, than Michael McCann, who just does a great job of explaining these complex issues in layperson terms. So we talk about Jack Del Rio, got really, really into that, his team imposing a fine on what he had to say and the legal issues surrounding when a team does it versus the league, whether he could appeal, how this sort of intersects other sports organizations. What could happen if, let's say, The Athletic tried to fine me for something I said? A lot of interesting stuff there. We got into the PGA Tour and LIV Golf in terms of each side perhaps thinking about suing on antitrust and contract claims. Talked about the Deshaun Watson case, Jenny Rentis's amazing reporting in the New York Times, and where that stands, and how the Browns really have no recourse to avoid that trade and what could come next. Finish up with Johnson versus the NCAA, a massive case before the Third Circuit that could really, really impact college athletics. Talked about states that have enacted legislation banning transgender students from participating in sports teams at public high schools and where that may be going. And then we finish up with the women's NCAA basketball tournament and what recourse some of these athletes might have in that that tournament is woefully sort of underserved in terms of how much money is going from a media outlet for that tournament. So Michael McCann coming up on the Sports Media Podcast. Let me put out here, you guys have been awesome in terms of providing feedback, where you review this podcast. Please continue to do that. Leave us a 5-star review and a nice note. That's how this podcast continues. And thank you so much for all the support on this. This is an independent podcast that's separate from The Athletic, and I really appreciate it. So coming up, Michael McCann on the Sports Media Podcast. All right, as I said at the top, we're joined by Michael McCann, a legal analyst and senior sports legal reporter at Sportico. He is a professor of law at the University of New Hampshire, New Hampshire's Franklin Pierce School of Law, where he is also the director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute. He was a longtime colleague of mine at Sports Illustrated. I will say this. I haven't told Mike exactly what I'm going to say, but it was such an absolute honor to work with the guy. He's so bright, smart. I think he's far and away the best person in terms of working today in the media space on explaining and analyzing legal issues in sports. Way back in the day at SI, we used to have a guy, Lester Munson, who was really famous for that a little bit before my time, but I feel like he was sort of the forerunner. And Michael McCann, to me, is that guy like in a 3.0 world. And the times I worked with him, and trust me, I brought very little to the table when those times existed. It was just great to work with this dude and to watch how his mind worked. And with that, Michael McCann, probably the nicest thing I've said to anybody in an intro in a while, welcome to the Sports Media Podcast.
Richard, thank you. And I hope your listeners know that it was an honor to collaborate with you on so many stories. It was really incredible the work we did together. And I miss it because there were some fun times we had unpacking all sorts of things. And thank you for the kind words. And I'm glad to be on your show.
Yeah, that's ridiculously too generous. And let me just say, to very be honest with Mike, there were so many reporters at Sports Illustrated when we worked there who are so far more accomplished than me when it comes to reporting, particularly on legal stuff. So, you know, occasionally when my world intersected with Mike on something, I was really a novice, and he was beyond helpful. So, you know, trust me, there are things that I'm strong at, like being an idiot. And this was not necessarily one of them. So I was really always really happy when Michael McCann was around. All right, Mike, we've got a number of things to talk about, but I want to go broad here to start with, because this is like interesting to me, and I just wonder how you see it. In the short time that I've known you, it seems like the intersection of legal and sports has increased multifold. It's not to say that these issues didn't exist before, but I don't know if we're in a more litigious time or more criminal time. Maybe that's the wrong way to say it. But it just seems, or certainly economics have played into this with colleges and stuff. But my interpretation of this is that what you are an expert in has grown exponentially, or the content of it has grown exponentially. Is that from your perspective, is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, the industry, the sports legal industry has grown dramatically in the last two decades. And why that's the case, I think there are a number of reasons. One is just the sports business has grown. So as a result, there are more folks involved, more companies involved, more disputes over contracts. I also think part of it is the role of sort of athlete empowerment, where athletes can use social media to communicate viewpoints that they couldn't before. There used to be a gatekeeper with the agent, with the team, sort of controlling the message. That's still there to some extent, but it's also faded a bit, where athletes have the direct ability to talk and give viewpoints that in some cases may generate controversy. Another reason I suspect is that it is more litigious, but also that there are more law firms with sports practices. And it's a growing field. And I tell my students this, that there are more firms with sports practices than ever before. And they do hire. They're hard jobs to get, no doubt. But part of it is also that the sort of field has grown. So there are more folks that are practicing in this area of law. So there's more disputes. But yeah, it has grown exponentially. And I don't see it slowing down. As you reference, the college sports industry really becoming more professionalized. Obviously, coaches have always made a lot of money. Now athletes are getting some benefits on that front. That will create new work as well.
One more sort of big picture, Mike, and then we'll get into some specifics. How do you distinguish between your legal read on something versus how you might feel about that issue morally? And is it a challenge to, I don't know, push down your own personal beliefs on something to render what you think is the legal analysis of it?
Yeah, I really try to be as detached as possible. And I think I've had some success with that, because when I'm teaching a class, I try to be neutral. And I think a good professor of law really tries to explain the law in a way that doesn't direct the students to feel like they have to adopt a certain viewpoint in order to do well in the course. So that kind of lens, I think, has helped me writing about sports legal issues, where I really do try to be neutral. And even when I don't agree with one side, I might firmly disagree, but I try not to show it in my writing. And I really try to think about what each side would argue, give each side their best case, and let the reader decide what's more persuasive.
All right, let's get into some specifics that are currently in the news. How do you look at the fine that was imposed by the Washington Commanders to Jack Del Rio from a sports law vantage point? And I read from you, so we'll just be clear, and you'll obviously explain it. The team is imposing the fine as opposed to the league, and that difference would have a lot to do with how what the recourse Del Rio might have or might not have. Can you explain, one, just sort of how you see it from the sports law vantage point, and two, the difference in that the fine is from the team as opposed to the NFL?
Yeah, there's several layers to this. And let's take the second part first, the fact that it was the team rather than the league. So when a league fines an executive or a coach, that's arguably problematic, because the executive or coach doesn't work for the league. and he or she is not part of a union that's in a CBA with the league, like a player is. So it's a peculiar thing where a league can actually punish someone who doesn't work for the league and isn't in a labor agreement with the league. And that's something that I've written about. Daryl Morey has been fined several times. So I've written about that in that context, where how does the NBA justify fining someone that doesn't actually work for the NBA and isn't an owner either, right? He's not an owner. So there's that piece to it. So when a team fines a coach, it is unusual, not because the coach doesn't work for the team, because the coach does. The odd part is that we haven't seen this happen, where a coach is fined. There are other penalties that are brought up with a coach. So a coach could be suspended, right? A coach could be warned. A coach could be put on what's called administrative leave, where you're still paid while the employer investigates. And usually there's something called progressive discipline, where you don't jump to a suspension. There's usually a warning first. But to fine a coach, to dock the coach pay, I talked to Tom Mars, who has litigated on behalf of coaches, both in the NFL and college. He said he's never seen a clause in a contract discussing that. So when we talk about Jack Del Rio, should he be punished for what he said? There's that piece. But then there's is this the right vehicle for punishing him? Is a fine, which maybe isn't contemplated by his contract, appropriate? And then secondly, with Del Rio, there is he has some ability. Does the contract say he can't give a political opinion? So the contract does, in all likelihood, we haven't seen his contract, so we're talking about coaches' contracts in general. The contract will contain some sort of morals clause saying, in effect, if the coach says something that damages the team's brand, the team can punish the coach. So arguably the Commanders can say, well, he gave a political opinion that was very controversial, that was hurtful, and he partially apologized for it. So it suggests that he acknowledged some wrongdoing in what he said. So maybe the team can say that gives them grounds, but we start to get into a tricky area, right? Because if it's okay to punish a coach for giving what we might call a very conservative viewpoint, would a coach be punished for giving a very liberal viewpoint that's also controversial? Does there have to be consistency? Does this concern other coaches when they give viewpoints, not only about the viewpoints, but then the vehicle of a fine? So those are some thoughts on that.
That's interesting. This would just be my analysis of it. I think had Del Rio been a member of a different organization and said that, and he's not referring to the city in particular that he's in, I wonder how that team would have reacted. They still may have fined. They still might not have. Maybe the dollar figure's different. So that's just an aside by me. But Mike, if you sort of take this a little bit further, because this would, I think, impact everybody in sports. It would impact both of us who work for media organizations. Is that the kind of clause that an organization will try to use in terms of fines or suspensions? Because like the reality is, like, we all have freedom of speech, but we don't have freedom of consequences from that speech if you work for a private employer, right? So is that, if I don't try to make this sort of like an example, so if Nikola Jokic said the exact same thing that Jack Del Rio did, he's obviously not going to, but let's sort of play it out for a little bit. Does it have to do with how the Denver Nuggets analyze whatever is in his contract regarding some kind of clause that would have detrimental impact to the organization? And again, I'm not a lawyer, but if I'm reading this right, isn't then so much of this ultimately the arbitrary judgment of a management group to determine whether this violation has happened?
Yeah, it's a great point. You nailed it. So as you said, freedom of speech, the First Amendment only protects us from the government taking action against us. It doesn't protect us from an employer, particularly a private employer, from taking action against us for speech. And in this context, like you said, it really depends on whether the contract permits a punishment for what the employee said. And I also agree with you that management gets a ton of discretion here, and maybe too much discretion, right? I mean, Sage Steele's lawsuit against ESPN, where, right? So is ESPN being, she argues ESPN's being inconsistent in how it enforces its policy against detrimental speech. Now, whether that's true or not could be debated, but this is a topic that I think we're seeing outside of coaching into sports media and other contexts about, does an employer, does management have to be consistent in policing speech that has political ramifications? I don't know. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it does what it wants, right? The remedy is always go get another job. That's sometimes the defense that's used, that if somebody doesn't like the sort of political philosophy of an employer, they can seek employment elsewhere. But I agree with you that Del Rio being in Washington has to be an important factor here, that if it had been any other team, it still would be controversial, but it's uniquely controversial given where the insurrection was.
You brought it up. So just let's just quickly do it. What do you think from what you've read of the Sage Steele lawsuit? And again, I'm going to try to do this in my best layperson terms. From what I understand, that Connecticut is an interesting state, right? In that it provides a little bit of different protection or rules for employees versus, let's say, if this suit was filed in, I'm making this up, New York or Nebraska. Can you explain why she may have a better chance of winning this because of the state she filed in?
Yeah, we wrote about this before with Jamil Hill. I mean, we've done some writing on this back in the day when we were at SI. So you're exactly right, Richard. Connecticut's law is different in that there's a statute which explicitly extends First Amendment protections to employees of private companies in a way that other states do not. Now, there's an asterisk to this. The asterisk is that that's true, but if the employee's conduct is considered detrimental, I can't think of the exact language of the state statute, the employer can still punish the person. So there's an out to this that ESPN can rely on, but it is a law that makes Sage Steele's case more viable than it would be in other states. And for her, she has argued that she was treated differently. Now, it's not clear that she was actually punished. I think that's one of the interesting parts about this. She wasn't fined.
Yeah. Well, there. I guess they'll claim, or their claims are, that she's still on the air. She's still being paid, right? So where is the, I guess if you're their counsel, you're arguing, well, there's no punishment here. Like, where is the punishment? And I guess, and again, maybe I'm guessing here, she would argue, well, the punishment is in the optics or the public opinion, like, kind of thing.
Yeah, she had to apologize. I think that she didn't get the same assignments. Also, her colleagues treated her poorly. It was embarrassing. So she would argue, even if there's not a formal sanction, she felt harmed by the manner in which she was treated.
Understood. All right, I assume that's one you're going to be following, and we'll write about when the adjudication happens. Is that something that can be appealed either way if one side loses?
Yeah, this could be in court a while. Although, you know, so this could also be settled tomorrow, right?
Settled. Yeah. No, I understand that. All right, that's an interesting one to follow. One last one on this Del Rio thing, and then we'll get to LIV Golf, because I'm always sort of curious about this. If as an employee, Mike, of The Athletic, and let's just, I'd have to check my contract, but let's pretend there's some kind of clause, not pretend. The presumption is this, I probably have a clause in there that says you can't do anything that disparages the brand. You can't do anything that brings bad favor to the brand, or however that works. If I am someone who is incredibly passionate, let's say, about gun control, and I had a child that, let's say, was horrific, like killed in a school shooting, like the most horrific thing you could think of, so this impacts me personally. And if I sort of say, like, this is a personal thing for me, my family was impacted, and I send out on my social media channels how I feel about this, ultimately that is a, one could determine that is a political viewpoint. If I say, like, you know, we need to do this, here are the legislators who are not doing this, can my company still, Mike, find me, fire me for that kind of violation, even though it is so intrinsically to who I am as a human being, and I could prove it's intrinsically who I am as a human being?
Yeah, so I think one is that if The Athletic did that, the harm they would suffer by doing so, the public harm, that people would say, how could you do that? right, would be pretty substantial. So the brand, I think the Athletic would be reticent before doing that because of the sort of damage to its brand if it punished an employee for that type of activity. But setting that aside, part of the issue would also be when that horrible thing occurred. Was it before or after the Athletic hired you? If the Athletic hired you, right, knowing that you're outspoken about this, you have a better argument that they sort of knew that going in than later on.
Boy, that's interesting. And I'm going to file that away because that's really interesting, I think, as an employee.
Imagine sleeping in the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's iconic sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code Odyssey. So head to B-O-L-L and Branch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million families building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey. That's greenlight.com/odyssey.
Let's get to LIV Golf. It's pretty interesting to me, and I am no golf fan, but I have to admit I've been like fascinated just by the and I don't say that flippantly. I mean, like, this is clear sports washing. You can't even argue against it, but there's a lot of legal issues here when it comes to what the players can or can't do, and I saw on Twitter that you mentioned this. So you offered multiple possibilities with the PGA Tour suspensions of these golfers regarding sort of the legal end. There's a possibility that the golfers can sue the PGA Tour on antitrust and contract claims, you say. This was interesting. LIV could sue the PGA Tour on antitrust and tortious interference claims. Golfers in LIV can sue the PGA Tour sort of as business partners, and then the PGA Tour could sue LIV for tortious interference, I guess, you know, stealing their employees. So this is really, really fascinating. And I guess I would ask you in a layperson's terms, like, does either side have a better path here if they were to head down a legal recourse?
So I think the tour has one advantage in that the golfers agreed to certain membership rules that clearly gave the tour discretion as to when it allows them to do other things, basically. And the golfers can say, well, you know, they've given exemptions in the past, so why don't they do it here? But that's not necessarily the greatest legal argument because the tour apparently has discretion. So I would say the tour has that working in its favor. But the antitrust piece is interesting because if the tour is really functioning as a monopoly over golf, essentially, then that allows the golfers and LIV to say, you are acting like a bully, essentially, right? You're preventing competition. You have this league that doesn't allow for competition, that tries to undermine potential competitors. In this context, there's so much money behind LIV that we have the wherewithal to overcome those institutional barriers that have maybe previously prevented rival competition that would be legitimate rival. And, you know, if it's an antitrust case, it will take a long time to play out and it will be a lot of money and it won't resolve the question of these particular golfers in any kind of quick period of time. It will be interesting to see if, in fact, the golfers, what a suspension actually means. Will they really be suspended? And I think I heard your comments earlier about, you know, will the tour sort of look at this to say, well, we can't enforce these suspensions because we need them. And I think part of this is just going to be sort of the practicality of it, where is there enough money? If the tour loses too many golfers, the tour is going to be harmed. So it can't be too aggressive either.
All right. So let me ask you a question, which I think like the average golf fan would really care about. Augusta National is the Masters is its own entity. It's separate from the PGA Tour, right? So I think they can make a decision as to whether these golfers, including some former champions, let's say, can play. If they determine, and I honestly have no idea what they're going to do, if they just determined and made a club rule or however, organizational rule that LIV, if you're part of this LIV golf series, you are not allowed to play in the Masters. Do any of the golfers have legal recourse to sue Augusta National to try to get a spot there, no, understanding that Augusta National is a private enterprise?
Yeah, the argument would be that Augusta National is conspiring with the tour and maybe other parties to exclude LIV golfers. That it's, that would go back to the antitrust argument of this industry is trying to prevent an insurgent rival league, and they're acting, they're conspiring, either explicitly or they're acting with parallel conduct, mindful of each other. So that, yeah, the golfer could say that this is all part of one conspiracy to exclude LIV. LIV could similarly join that kind of lawsuit to say, you're all trying to prevent us from being, you don't want competition and you're undermining competition. And they would argue the fan is hurt. That's the key with an antitrust case. The key is the fan. Is the fan deprived opportunities to watch other tournaments that feature great players? And you could argue the market's better off when there are rival leagues that are real competitors. We see that in other industries. Sports is unique where we don't really see that. There's one NFL, there's one Major League Baseball, but it doesn't mean golf can't have multiple top leagues.
Would, if you were an LIV golfer that wanted to try to take on the PGA Tour, would it benefit you more to try to file in the United States or abroad, a place like England?
If the case probably goes back to the U.S., I'm guessing, because of the membership of the tour membership is based in the U.S. So even if you file abroad through sort of civil procedure mechanisms, the case might migrate back to the United States. But from my understanding of laws in Europe, they're much more scrutinizing of restraints on competition. So there may be a tactical advantage to filing in Europe, although that doesn't mean the case will ultimately be heard there.
Let's talk about Deshaun Watson. Our old colleague Jenny Vrentis has done some incredible reporting on Deshaun Watson and the legal issues that exist there. Her reporting found that Watson booked appointments with at least 66 different women from the fall of 2019 to the spring of 2021. As you mentioned, I might have seen this on your Twitter feed. A few of these women have spoken publicly for the first time. They describe experiences, which I think this would be my interpretation, clearly undercut Deshaun Watson's insistence that he was just there for massage therapy. So there's a lot of sort of issues I want to ask you about this, Mike, but where things stand now, what is next here? Is next, at least in terms of Deshaun Watson, the NFL will, in theory, continue to try to investigate and talk to these women to glean more information about the, as best as they can understand what has happened here?
So what's next, at least based on what's been leaked, is an expectation that the NFL will punish Deshaun Watson this summer before training camp starts. I think their training camp starts on July 28th, that they'll impose some sort of suspension. But here's the issue. If the NFL thinks that this is a much bigger scandal than they originally thought, and Jenny Vrentis, as you said, her terrific reporting. I mean, think of like just to say for a second, like this, there's been so much energy devoted into this story. The fact that she found all these other people after this really, amazing, really just impressive, really great journalism. But the NFL, maybe the NFL knew about these people, but maybe not. And I don't know if they can act so quickly if there are all these other accusers, even if they don't go to court. Like you said, they're still leveling the same basic allegation that he acted inappropriately, if not unlawfully, and that he wasn't entirely interested in a massage service. And maybe that was really a secondary interest of him in recruiting them through Instagram. So maybe the NFL won't act this summer. I don't know. But I think the expectation is the NFL will punish him. But here's the problem for Watson and the Browns. The NFL can punish him again later on. If there are other accusers, if there's new information, This isn't a Ray Rice situation where there was one horrible incident and a belief that the NFL didn't act on all of the information it knew. This would be numerous accusers who the list keeps growing. And also the number of lawsuits keeps growing. I mean, this is over a year, 24. I mean, who knows how many others are going to come? This is really, I've never seen anything like this. Think about it, 24 law. I mean, this isn't even a class action. These are 24 individual lawsuits. When have we ever seen this?
Yep. Never. So again, I'm going to be a massive cynic here. And if the NFL tells me that they're concerned about these women and their well-being, I don't believe it. I'm sorry. I don't. I'm not saying there aren't people in the NFL office who might, but the reality, at least from my perspective, is that the NFL cares about its image. And it cares about what should – it cares about, do we want this person on the field in a historic franchise representing the league? So to me, Mike, I wonder on the legal terms when it comes to the investigation and whatever Goodell's power is, like, are they, do they have the capacity to determine, like, this player being detrimental to the image of the league – and then using that as part of their jurisdiction on how long they would suspend him. So again, let me just—I know they're not going to do this, but could there be an argument or legal argument to say, if this person plays in our league, we think it's going to have a significant detrimental impact on our league. Thus, we are suspending this person for 5 years. They're not going to do that, but like, do you know what I'm sort of trying to get at? Like, do they? Could they have the recourse to really set some kind of arbitrary number based on their interpretation of this is significantly hurting our league and thus the punishment has to be significant?
Yeah, so the short answer is yes. And you're really alluding to this is a workplace policy. It's not the law. And the NFL doesn't have to rely on whether there's a lawsuit, whether there's a crime, whether there's a charge, whether there's a dismissal. The NFL is applying a workplace policy, and if it determines that the player, in this case Watson, acted so egregiously and so detrimental to the league's interests that it warrants a multi-year suspension, they could reach that. There's no cap on how long a suspension can be. Now, that said, there would be a grievance process in all likelihood, though it would go back to Goodell. Actually, let me rephrase. Goodell doesn't make the initial determination. It's someone neutral, it's former Judge Robinson, who will decide what is the appropriate punishment, though either Watson or the league can appeal her ruling, and it goes to Goodell. So Goodell ultimately has final say, though, as we know from Tom Brady and Deflategate, the player can petition a federal court to review what Goodell decides as the arbitrator. So maybe it does wind up in federal court, and the federal courts are pretty deferential to arbitrators. So the short answer is, yeah, they could decide a multi-year suspension is appropriate. I think the counter argument would be there's no past practice of that. That right. Seems really...
The PA would become involved in this as a course of, even if they don't like Deshaun Watson, right, there's principles at play.
Yeah, because they don't want a precedent set where there's a multi-year suspension for anything. And they will absolutely fight it. And I think the league is mindful of that they don't want to create a new precedent. But here's the thing. Could there be a year suspension? Yeah, but he could lose a year. I don't think that's beyond the realm of possibility given the unique situation that's here.
The you mentioned this, and this is very interesting on a legal thing. Do the Browns have any recourse to void the trade? And to me, my thought here, and again, this is just a layperson's take, I would think they're not on really great legal ground here, because how can you make the argument you didn't know that this stuff existed, or at least some of this stuff existed when you made the trade?
Yeah, Richard, there were 22 lawsuits when they made the trade. So why is 24 lawsuits suddenly grounds to void a deal when they knew about 22? And also they patted themselves on the back saying they did all this due diligence on him.
They held that press conference we believe in him, right? And we're comfortable with him being part of our organization, kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't see a viable argument they can try to get out of the trade. They shouldn't. They went out of their way to say they did background on him, and also even setting that aside, if there are 22 lawsuits against someone and you trade for that person, you own that, right? Like, I don't understand. I don't see how you back up and say, well, I didn't know about these other two, but why is 24 bad, but 22 is okay? It just doesn't add
100%.
Up.
Yeah. I mean, you own the cynical nature of your trade, I would say. How detrimental for Deshaun Watson was Rusty Hart and his lawyer making those comments on the radio station about happy endings? He's sort of basically saying that, like, I guess, like, well, what's the big deal if this if this happened? But you sort of get into this. Well, then what he's really would be saying, right, is that, like, Deshaun Watson wasn't really going there for a massage. He was going there for something else. Again, I don't even know if it'd be admissible in any kind of court or hearing, but I don't know. That seemed to me to be a lawyer maybe doing a little too much press and making a mistake for his client.
Yeah, and Harden's a great lawyer. I mean, look, the guy has had a long, distinguished career. Everyone messes up, and I think that was a mess up. And it sort of implied that, okay, he's there for a massage that he pays for, and then after the massage ends, he also has some sort of sexual activity that he didn't pay for. I mean, it gets really right. A lot of ifs. It's a convoluted account that I think would strike many to say, if he's going there, at least in part, to have some sort of sexual service, that's prostitution. That's a crime. And that's not an adequate defense. That's not an effective defense against a civil claim of assault. So
yeah, not to mention, I think he opens up the door for the women who seem very truthful about, you know what I'm saying? His flippancy, I think, hurts his larger case that this was all a professional, that his client went there just for a professional medical athletic right. service.
That's right. That's right. Because how could it be that he only went there for that, and then, as luck would have it,
right,
he also had these sexual, I mean, whether it's actual sex or short of sex.
Correct.
I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I agree. Like, just logically, it doesn't. All right, let's as we start to close here, I want you to tell my audience, because it seems very clear that you consider this a pretty significant case. Johnson versus the NCAA, which is before the Third Circuit, and why this is important.
Yeah, the basic reason why this case is important is that it argues if the work-study student who might have a scholarship that's at the game, taking your ticket, telling you where to sit, selling you popcorn, if that student gets paid minimum wage, then why doesn't the athlete? That's the basic question in this case. And the law is the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is not the kind of law that we've heard about with players unionizing and signing contracts and CBAs. It merely provides minimum wage and overtime pay to qualified employees. And that's why I think this case, it's been kind of overlooked, which to me is interesting, because the college sports media, as you know, Richard, is so, like, devoted, right? I mean,
yeah.
the
amount of like there's NIL reporters, it seems like, every day. So, yeah.
And on the Alston case, there's, like, you know, three people writing about it every second. So I'm struck by sort of the lack of attention paid towards this case. And maybe because it isn't as sexy. We're talking about getting paid minimum wage, but that's a game changer. If college athletes are owed minimum wage, not only the ones now, but the ones before, that number gets pretty big. And it also would mean it sort of recalculates the economics of college sports if they should be paid. So I think the case is significant. We'll see what the Third Circuit does. This argument hasn't worked in other circuits. It's been tried in the Ninth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit, but times are different. And this case has a district court ruling that is extremely favorable to the players. So we'll see.
Do schools have a legitimate argument to say that, like, if this happens, it's just going to be too cost prohibitive for everybody except a handful of athletic departments, you know, like the Alabamas or the, you know, fill in your super, like, you know, supercharged school like Stanford that has billions of dollars in funding and stuff like that? It's like, is that a legit argument?
I'm not sure. So I asked Paul McDonald, he's the lead counsel, and he said, well, think about it. Do the math. Let's say they get paid $25 an hour. If we use the NCAA's 20-hour per week limit of sports activities, then it's $500 a week, $2,000 a month over 4 to 5 months of a season. We're talking $8,000 to $10,000. offered by now some schools that actually is a lot of money. So I wouldn't, want to down
lower level division one, maybe, but I find that one hard to believe that, I don't know, you know, Penn State or Michigan, like, you know, these are big athletic budgets here.
Yeah. And look what they're paying coaches, right? Or the new facility or the 13th trainer. Right. So I think that the money concern is much less persuasive at those major schools, though I do concede that you leave the top 30, 40 schools, the economics change pretty dramatically.
I agree with that. All right. All right. Two more quick ones here. The rise of college swimmer Leah Thomas, a transgender woman, ignited a firestorm over who should be allowed to compete in women's sports. We've seen some good faith discussion. We've seen, man, a ton of bad faith discussion and culture war monetization over this. When I looked, at least 12 states have enacted legislation banning transgender students from participating in sports teams at public high schools. I wanted to ask you, like, how you see this litigation possibly playing out. We're seeing bills advocated by people who oppose transgender kids playing sports with cisgender teammates. Many times it's not a lot of actual transgender kids playing sports. Like, the numbers are not very low in these particular states. But, and again, this is my layperson thing. Is this something, Mike, that ultimately will have to be determined federally, where there's a federal statute, or like many of these other issues, will this be a state-by-state thing, and some states will approach it one way and then other states will approach it another way? And generally speaking, a lot of this falls along political or culture kind of lines.
Yeah, so for now, I think it's a state-by-state thing. And then over the long run, I expect there will be some sort of either federal interpretation. President Biden had issued an executive order earlier in his presidency which signaled, although more really an aspirational language rather than sort of actionable language, that there would not be discrimination on the basis of sexual identity in the locker room, I think was the word used, which obviously implies sports. But that hasn't led to sort of a formal change of law at a federal level. And even if there's a federal law passed on this, it could be challenged as going beyond the rights of states and acting in a way that states should have sort of sovereignty over this particular question, as states often do with matters of health and sports. So, you know, this is not going to have a resolution anytime soon. And I suspect, I mean, this could end up in the Supreme Court through some vehicle or another. And that would certainly be interesting to follow.
Yeah. And that, at least, again, my sense is that given the makeup of the court, would have an impact on how that might be rendered federally. Last one for me, and this is, again, this is a kind of a just a one for myself, because I happen to like the sport. I covered it for many years at Sports Illustrated. So the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament, Mike, which I think you are a fan of as well, if they ever could get to market to try to get a rights fee for that sport, either on a season-long basis or even, let's just take the women's Final Four, they would get millions and millions of dollars for that property. In this case, at the moment, that is all rolled up by the NCAA along with all some of these other sports outside of college football and college basketball, where ESPN has paid the NCAA a rights fee to sort of broadcast, you know, women's basketball championships, track and field championships, you know, women's swimming, et cetera. Do the college athletes playing right now, would they have any legal recourse to try to get more money for, like, the rights of what they are doing from some media organization? And again, this is, you know, I've been using this line 100 times, but because I am a layperson, unlike you and my sister, the smart lawyers out there. do they have any recourse? I mean, could they decline playing? Could they sit in the middle of the court and say, like, you know, until a resolution happens, we're not going to play? Like, do the students have any, I don't know, actionable recourse here? Because in a sport like that, like, millions of dollars have been left off the table because of a decision by the NCAA, and in some ways, a decision by a media outlet too.
Yeah, so they could sit out. There could be, but this is the tough part. Do you get everyone to agree to do that? And I think that's always been the challenge with that kind of step. There is a case, a federal case called House versus NCAA, which involves Sedona Prince, the former.
I didn't know that.
And the basic take of that case is all these years where NIL wasn't allowed, those athletes should be able to get money from money they could have earned. But interestingly, in that case, it extends to TV rights. So the argument is that NIL is not just what we think of it normally, endorsement deals, sponsorships, but appearing on TV. And we know that pro athletes are compensated for appearing on TV through TV deals. Why is it that ESPN pays to broadcast NBA games? The players are getting about half of that through the collective bargaining agreement, basketball-related income. There's some value to it, clearly. So why wouldn't the players at the college level get it? Now, the argument is that, well, they're not the producers of the game, that how would the money be divided? There's no union. There's no trade. Right. So there's all these sort of, it's too complicated arguments. But, you know, I always say if the argument is it's too complicated, then you figure out a way of solving it.
Yeah. Mike, when I was back on Twitter, that phenomenally, you know, fun place that I know you love so much, I feel like the best thing I've ever tweeted in like the last couple of years is I wrote, I think ESPN should broadcast the college football playoff national championship for the love of the game. Go commercial free, accept no ad dollars, no promoting Disney products, no executive takes a paycheck that week. On-air talent does it all for gratis. Do it for the love of the game. And that was like one of the things that actually really got a lot of pickup. But I was proud of myself for that because I thought, if nothing else, it sort of exposed this has always been an economic enterprise for those who have made money. And it's been really interesting to see in the last couple of years that when the labor, the product, actually starting to get money, the arguments that we sort of have heard as to why the product itself should not make money.
It's they're getting a scholarship. That's my favorite. Well, first of all, they're not always getting a scholarship. They're often not a full scholarship. And work study students get scholarships and still get paid work study. So, you know, the notion that these knee jerk defenses don't always withstand scrutiny.
Yeah. Well said. Mike, I could talk to you for hours. This is always fascinating to me. Let me give your many titles here. Michael McCann is a legal analyst and senior sports legal reporter at Sportico. Check out that publication for sure. He's also a professor of law at the University of New Hampshire's Franklin Pierce School of Law, where he's the director of sports the director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute. Mike, for many, many years, he's really taught like some interesting classes at his university, including on Deflategate, and just some other stuff. So at a very minimum, like follow him on social media, check out his work on Sportico. But if you're also into and I know a lot of people from academia listen to this podcast, you should just check out what he's doing, because you may actually be able to glean something or even steal something from the classes that he's been doing, because he's doing a lot of interesting stuff that I haven't seen in many other sports law classes. Mike, it's great to catch up with you. Continued success. And thanks so much for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast.
You got it. Thanks for having me, Richard. It was a lot of fun.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Michael McCann for popping on today. He was terrific. I also had a previous Sports Illustrated colleague as well this week, Emily Kaplan, who's doing great work on their NHL coverage. You'll see her during the Stanley Cup Final on ABC and ESPN+. Head to the archives page. There should be some stuff you like. Haley Rosen, founder and CEO of Just Women Sports, did a couple of sports media roundtables with Chad Finn and Austin Karp. Lindsey Jones, my colleague at The Athletic, was recently on this podcast. Tony Khan of All Elite Wrestling. Tom Verducci on Roger Angel and The Art of Baseball Writing. Again, head to the archives. There should be some stuff that you will enjoy. Thanks to Patrick Antonetti for sure. Thanks to everybody at Cadence 13 for their support. And thank you for listening. We'll see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League Podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.